What is the purpose? What is the driver behind the progressive Democrats that it's always been there to get rid of the ability for people to own and carry guns, to defend themselves? What's behind that? In your estimation, at least, what do you think is behind it?
Right. Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. There's basically a couple things that are going on. One is, if you look at self-identified liberals and conservatives, the one issue that most differentiates self-identified liberals and conservatives has been their views on gun control, more than abortion, because you have a lot of otherwise liberal Catholics who may feel strongly against abortion, more than taxes. It's whether or not you support more gun control or not has been the big dividing issue. And I think part of that is just due to who do you trust? So conservatives may say, look, I think people should make their own healthcare decisions. You shouldn't have the government deciding what they should do. But a lot of liberals don't think people are responsible or capable enough to go and make those decisions, so they want to make them for them. But in the case of guns, when you're talking about weapons, it's kind of the ultimate question of who do you trust? Do you trust individuals, or do you not trust them because, you know, here they have a weapon? So if you can't trust them to make their healthcare decisions, how are you going to trust them to go and, properly possess a weapon? But I think it's more than that. I think that explains part of it. Over the years, I've talked to a number of people who are on Capitol Hill, Democrats, others, and what's often been told to me, because I've asked the same type of question you've asked, is I think they view gun owners are to Republicans what unions are to Democrats. So let me give you an analogy. I strongly support school choice. I support it because of the fact that, you know, competition seems like an obvious way to me to improve the quality of schools. I mean, I just feel very strong. I feel the people who are hurt the worst by the poorest public school system we have are the people who are less able to escape it. And basically you have poor blacks, poor minorities who live in these urban areas are really having an unconscionably bad education being given to their kids. And I think they would benefit the most. But as a side effect of this, and again, this isn't the motivating factor for me, but if you were to go to, let's say, vouchers or tax credits and have a competitive system out there, teachers' unions would disappear. There's no way a teachers' union could represent a school if you have competition, because everybody would leave that school. Because, you know, if teachers are just trying to get cushier jobs or not work hard or not having to be evaluated, those schools would go out of business. And if you ended up having the teachers' unions go out of business, you would have not only better education, but you'd also have it so that you'd have a very changed political environment, I think, in this country. Teachers' unions provide 25% or so of the delegates at each Democratic National Convention every 4 years. They're one of the biggest donors and probably the biggest single union donor for Democrats each time, and they provide the shock troops. And so anyway, I think a lot of Democrats, you know how important unions are to them, but they think, and there's some truth to this, that gun owners tend to vote overwhelmingly Republican, and it trending more that way over time, and that they think that they can weaken Republicans in the long run if they can reduce gun ownership. So I think
that makes sense. That makes perfect sense.
It sure does. I never thought about that, but that's a really interesting position. And it's literally a political battle.
Well, I think it's part. I mean, I think they also believe, I think they're wrong, but I think they also believe the safety claims that are made there. But I think it's more than that, because you see them pushing it, even though sometimes where it doesn't look like it's in their short run political advantage. And I think they're just thinking longer term on this stuff. So, you know, a lot of the push in gun control over the last few years, as we've been talking about, has been to impose taxes and fees and other costs on people being able to go and obtain guns. And I think It's just their recognition that if they can go and do that, they can reduce gun ownership and to some extent make people less independent and make them and, you know, make it easier for them to go and vote Democrat.
Yeah, you just hit on another thing.
If they can't do it, they can tax them and get more money from them, too.
And think of what else John just said. He said by removing those guns, you make people more dependent.
Yeah.
Which is the left is always about dependency. John, let me ask you some fact questions, if I could. What is it? And I've read your books and they're great. I really highly recommend them. Let's take a look at some cities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, New York, L.A. How does their strict gun laws play out compared to Florida or Texas or places where you can have guns?
Right. Well, one thing I try to make clear in my books is I'm not really a big fan on just comparing two places next to each other. And the reason is that there are lots of reasons why crime rates can vary. So, for example, one question I'm often brought up with, you know, Piers Morgan, when I'd be on CNN, would bring this up all the time. He'd say, well, you know, why? Look at the UK, they have few guns and they have a low murder rate. So therefore, it must be the fact that they have low gun ownership, which is causing the low murder rate. My response to Piers, which never seemed to get through to him, was that UK's murder rate was even lower before they had the gun control rules. For example, in the UK, that when they banned handguns in January 97, there was about a 50% increase in homicides over the next 8 years there in the country. It was a very dramatic increase that started right after the ban was put in place. And it started falling after that 8 years, after 9 years on, but that was only after they had a massive 14% increase in the number of police officers right at that time. And there are lots of reasons. Like, I'll give you an example. You go back to 1900. I mean, this is obviously much farther than 97. But in the UK, it was amazing how few murders they had. They had no gun regulations. In a city of London where they had like 8 million people, there were a gun ownership very widespread. There was two gun murders. There were five armed robberies. I mean, I can't even get my head around such incredibly low crime rates that they had there with guns.
They have more crime right now with the gun ban.
Right. And so, you know, there was obviously something different there about London and the UK relative to the United States and other places in 1900.
And, well, when did these things start to happen? Because they happened in France, they happened in Italy, they happened in Britain. When did all this move to ban guns in these countries start to happen? What was the trigger? Something had to trigger.
It varies in different places, but in the UK, for example, the first gun control law they had was in 1920. And the reason why they had that was because you just had the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and World War I had ended, and you had a lot of unemployed soldiers there. And the concern was is that all these unemployed soldiers could get unhappy and you could have a revolution in the UK. And so their notion was to essentially make it fairly difficult for relatively poor people to be able to go and own guns.
So in other words, the reason we have the Second Amendment was what they were fearing. Part of the whole gun ownership thing in the Constitution was to prevent a tyrannical government.
Right.
And it sounds like that's what they were worried about.
Right. Look, I don't really argue Second Amendment type stuff. There are plenty of groups, plenty of other individuals who do that type of thing. To me, the bottom line is safety. And I guess what I've come to believe over time is that, you know, you look at the debate, there are people who believe strongly in freedom as the motivation. That's fine. But for the vast majority of people in the middle of the debate, safety trumps it. And you can't just argue freedom with people. You have to explain to them why the different gun control laws actually endanger safety. And I believe strongly, I mean, my views have changed a lot over time on this issue, that that's the key thing that's going on there. That if you make it so that poor people can't afford to buy guns, or make it hard for women to be able to go and defend themselves, there's a real cost to that. So you go and ban Saturday night specials, which is basically just a ban on inexpensive guns. Well, it's true there's some criminals that use inexpensive guns, but there's a lot more poor individuals who would use an inexpensive gun for protection. And you go and you impose these taxes or fees, you have to be cognizant of who you're disarming as a result of that.
Well, and of course, the police are always brought up. That's what it is. You call the police, and of course, they respond after the fact. And everyone knows that. And it's interesting because I think that the liberal community at large, that is the voter, and especially women, from my experience, and it's short-lived, but still my experience, has been they are becoming more and more attuned to their safety. Exactly what you talked about. What's going to keep me safe? The
Right.
police can't keep me safe. They're going to respond to the problem that I have later. So it's going to be up to me to keep me safe. And I'm alone, and I have no one else to depend on. So what do I do? It's a dog. It's a gun. It's an alert system. It's a home protection system. And it's now starting to come down to, I think that a lot of women are saying, you know what? I need a gun to keep me safe, and I want to learn how to use one, and I want to be a responsible citizen and have ownership. And they're the left, most of these women, and now they're coming up against their own political left. So
Right.
that's a very interesting thing that's happening in my view today.
Right. You bring up a lot of points here. Let me deal with two general ones. One is just the view of police on gun ownership. Police, particularly rank and file police officers, are probably the strongest proponents in the country of private ownership of
Right.
guns.
Absolutely.
The largest private organization of police officers in the United States is called Police One. Again, if you go to our website, crimeresearch.org, you'll see, and just search under Police One, you'll see the survey data that they put together on their members. They have like 450,000 members. If you ask them, do they support concealed carry, even more liberal concealed carry than in most states, you'll get like over 91% of police officers support that. If you ask them, are guns important for reducing crime, you'll have about 87% say that's either extremely important or very important in terms of reducing crime to have private ownership of guns. These guys know exactly what, Chuck, you were saying a minute ago, and that is they realize that they're very important. I think they're probably the single most important factor for reducing crime. But even though they're extremely important for reducing crime, they realize what you were just saying, and that is they realize that they virtually always arrive on the crime scene after it's occurred. And they know in their own lives how important guns are for protecting their safety. And that makes them sympathetic for individuals being able to have guns for protection.
Paris is a great example of police not having guns, and it just happened.
Right. No. Well, look, it's more than that. It's an example of the problems with civilians not having guns too. Here you
True.
have
I agree with you.
all the weapons that were used in these attacks were illegal in France. The handguns were illegal, the machine guns were illegal, the grenades were illegal, the smoke grenades were illegal, the body armor was illegal. You could go, the sticks of dynamite were illegal. Everything that they had basically was illegal for somebody to possess. And some of these guys had violent criminal records. This is not France. Last May, there was an attack in Belgium that was extremely similar, which killed people at a Jewish museum. Look, the response is to what? The response is to go and put 10,000 military troops in uniform in front of Jewish sites. That's fine. I'm sure that it makes some people feel safer, but it's pretty useless. And the thing you have to understand there, I get back to the women thing. We got off on this a little bit, but I just finished this. The thing is, you have to understand, is that terrorists have a huge strategic advantage. And the advantage is they determine the time and the place for the attack. And this is something Israel learned the hard way. So let's say you have a terrorist on a bus and you have two police officers. Well, what can the terrorist do? Well, he has at least a couple options. One is he can simply wait patiently until the police officers leave and then engage in this attack. Or two, he could kill the police officers who are in uniform and readily identifiable and then kill the other people. And for decades, from when the country was started up until 72, the approach from Israel was always to put more military, more police on the street after one of these terrorist attacks occurred with a machine gun someplace. But at some point, they began to realize that, look, no matter how much money we spend, no matter how many troops we put on the street, if these terrorists are patient enough, they're going to find some opening in order to go and attack people. And so what they did is they started allowing civilians to be able to carry handguns. And it's been as high as 15% of the adult Jewish population has been able to carry. And what that has done is it's taken away the huge strategic advantage the terrorists have. That now, even when the police leave the bus, they don't know if there may be somebody in front of them, to the side, or behind them that might be able to go and stop them. And what you find is that virtually all the terrorist attacks prior to 72 involved machine guns, and virtually all the terrorist attacks after 72 involved bombs. And there's a reason for that, is that if somebody pulls out a machine gun, you give people a chance to respond. If they set off a suicide bomb, then there's nothing to really respond to. But the interesting thing is that when terrorists had a choice between what to do, to use a bomb or a machine gun prior to 72, they invariably chose using machine guns.
Well, the gun's a lot easier.
Right. Well, also the mortalities per attack also tended to be higher. Putting these armed soldiers in front of Jewish sites, you know, there was one of the leading rabbis in Europe this week came out and asked that Jews be able to go and carry handguns with them. Of course, as you were saying earlier, Chuck, they don't even let a lot of police carry handguns on duty or surely off. And so the notion that they're going to let Jews carry guns is like completely unrealistic or unlikely to happen. But, you know, if it were me, there are like 200,000 police officers in France. Why not let them carry guns off duty?
And things will change. It's like putting a stoplight at the intersection. Eventually, you have enough wrecks, the stoplight will go up, and maybe this will change, and maybe it won't. I don't know. I know one thing for sure. I do believe that the emotions behind it and the stories behind it will be the key that will probably change people's minds. And the understanding and fear that people have in everyday life of having to defend themselves and feeling like they need to defend themselves is starting to change now. I believe it's starting to change because we're getting in a far more dangerous world, it seems to me, every day. Yeah. And so,
and Chuck, let me add something in there. John was talking, you were talking about people who believe that, you know, the job of the police is to keep you safe. Now, as you know, Chuck, I used to be a cop. I want to make something really clear to people. Police do not carry guns to keep you safe. Police carry guns to keep them safe.
I think police are extremely important. You know, they put their lives on the line. I've done a lot of work on policing and policing policies. I could talk to you about that for hours. But, you know, I think to me, I don't really see the point in questioning the motivations for police too much. They do a good job. They do an important job. And they also support policies to let individuals protect themselves. And to me, that seems like the bottom line there.
No, absolutely. My point on that is, no, we're in total support of the police. Yeah, the point is that the police are not there to be our personal bodyguards. It's our responsibility to keep ourselves safe. So John, I know we're coming up here against the end, and real quick, a couple thoughts for you here is, I wanted to ask you, I see that some of the, and again, I'm not trying to get into, you know, isolating markets, but I see this kind of being a little of a broad complaint where the areas that have the greatest gun control keep blaming the surrounding areas on why their gun control doesn't work.
Right. Well, I mean, that's, look, we've saw that when Washington, D.C. and Chicago banned guns.
Well, they say they bring them in from Virginia if you're in Washington. Right, well, exactly. That's Virginia. You know, they can buy them there and bring them in here, and then they shoot us all up.
Yeah, I guess my response is a couple fold. One is, you know, it would have been nice if they had said, wow, you know, we don't expect these laws to work before they got passed. They kind of come up with this excuse afterwards. But I don't think, you know, this doesn't really explain why the murder rate went up. Presumably those guns were available beforehand, you know, in the place and outside afterwards. So I think it only explains why it didn't go down as much as they were promising. But the thing is, you can look at other places. You can look at entire countries that have banned guns. You can look at island nations that have banned guns. And so if you go to our website at crimeresearch.org, you'll see graphs where I have data on island nations where there's no neighbor to go and blame to do it, you know, well-defined, easily defendable borders. And yet what you have happen is that you see huge, massive increases in murder rates and violent crimes after guns are banned. And here's the bottom line. Every single place in the world that I have crime data before and after a gun ban, whether it's all guns or all handguns, every single time murder rates have gone up. And they've often gone up by a huge amount. And so, you know, somebody may be able to have an excuse saying, well, you know, this happened here or this happened there. But you would think at some point they would say, look, you know, at least randomness would get us one or two places where the murder rate would have gone down after a ban.
Right. There's no outlier any place. It's 100%, you're saying.
Right. Every single place. And it's usually huge increases that happen in terms of the murder rate. And I think there's a simple explanation for what's going on. And that is when you ban guns, it's basically the most law-abiding good citizens who turn them in, not the criminals. I mean, you may disarm criminals to some extent, but it's primarily disarming the law-abiding victims that are there. And rather than making it more difficult for criminals to commit crime, it actually makes it relatively easier for them to commit crime.
John, do you have any opinion or stats on the existence of gun-free zones?
Right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, these attacks in France are no different than all these other. Every single mass shooting in Europe since at least 1950 has occurred in places where guns are banned, even in Switzerland. Switzerland basically had no gun-free zones prior to like 1999. After that, there's some government buildings that they've had gun-free zones. The mass shootings that have occurred, you have a shooting in 2001 in the parliamentary canton of Zug in their parliament building, in which 14 people were killed. You had another couple shootings, one in 2006 and one in 2009, and all those occurred where guns are banned, you know, across Europe in general. And in the United States, with just two exceptions, over that same period of time, every single mass public shooting in which at least four people were killed has taken place where guns are banned. At some point, people would think you'd realize that this isn't random because, you know, in most states, you know, Pennsylvania here or, you know, Texas or whatever, you may have some businesses that ban it, but 98 or 99% of the places you can go to, you know, people are allowed to carry permit concealed handguns. And if it was random, then, you know, a huge percentage of these mass shootings would take place where guns are allowed, and they're not. And just look at this last year. Time after time, evidence comes out that indicates that these attackers chose the venue that they did because they didn't have to worry about people being able to stop them with guns. So you look at the Santa Barbara shooting, a killing last year. I don't know if you've read the killer's 141-page manifesto that he puts out.
I'm waiting for the movie on that one.
Well, anyway, you know, once you get by the fact that he's upset that women don't appreciate what a great guy he is, and that, anyway, he goes through in amazing detail why he chose the targets that he did. And so one example, I mean, there's several like this, but one example is he goes through a discussion about, well, he thought about targeting spring break in Santa Barbara because apparently Santa Barbara is kind of the in place for students from around California and even a lot of the West to go during spring break. And he said, you know, this is ideal. It's a target-rich environment with lots of students that he'd want to kill. But he'd gone and done his homework, looked at old YouTube videos, checked it out in newspapers and what have you. And he said, look, there are just a lot of police there. And he may be able to kill some of the police, but there's just no way he could kill enough of them before he'd have a chance to really kill many of the students that he wanted to kill. You look at the Canadian mass shooting last year in Moncton, New Brunswick. That killer actually on his Facebook page had multiple comics about gun-free zones. He, you know, one comic, for example, he had a victim who was stumbling, trying to run away, stumbling, he was going away, and he has a bubble over his head, and he's yelling back at the killer who's killing people. He said, look, guns are banned here. You're not allowed to have a gun to go and shoot people. And so as the killer is pointing his gun at the person, presumably ready to shoot him also, he has a bubble above his head saying, what a moron, basically, and then he shoots him. You take the Aurora, Colorado, the Batman movie theater shooting. This is very typical. You had 7 movie theaters showing the premiere of the Batman movie on the day that he attacked, that were within a 20-minute drive of the killer's apartment. Only one of those movie theaters posted signs banning permanent concealed handguns. The killer didn't go to the movie theater that was closest to his home. He didn't go to the one that advertised itself prominently as having the largest auditoriums in the state of Colorado, something on a premiere night, which would give him lots of victims to go after. Instead, he went to the only movie theater that prevented people from being able to go and defend themselves. We know he cased the places. And I could go through lots of examples that are very similar to those cases.
Well, it kind of shows that mass shooters are crazy, but they're not stupid.
Chilling thing is that time after time, they're explicit on what their goal is. They want to get media attention. And these guys will explicitly say things like, well, if I can kill more people than were killed in Columbine, I'll get more attention.
If there's one thing you could leave our audience with, what would it be?
Well, I mean, guns make it bad things to happen easier, but they also make it so people can defend themselves and prevent bad things from happening. And that police are extremely important, but they understand that they can't be there all the time. And that by far the safest course of action for people to take when they're confronted by a criminal, and this is particularly true for women and
older people,
blacks, and older people and poor blacks, is to have a gun. That's by far the safest course of action for them to take.
And I want to add something to that and learn how to use it.
Absolutely, responsibly. John, thank you so much. John Lott, ladies and gentlemen, that is so much information to digest, and yet you made your points very well, and you are a professor, so it makes sense. Thank you, sir.
I've been a professor for like 25 years. I'm not right now. I just started this Crime Prevention Research Center. I got tired of political correctness in academia. I'm just trying
to... Good for
to,
you. So are we.
John, real quick, if you want to give us out the website where people can get in touch with you or get more information about you.
Sure. It's crimeresearch.org. And if they go there and they want to be on our email list so they can go and see the studies that we put out and the pieces that we write.
Great information, folks. I also want to recommend John's books. If you go to bluntforcetruth.com, we'll have links to John's website, the names of the books and everything there where you can get it. By the way, if you like the show, please go to iTunes, go to Stitcher, leave us a review. That really helps. And if you're not getting the shows downloaded automatically to your device, subscribe. That's the easiest way to get them to get the program delivered right to your phone or your device without having to wait for it. So anyways, John, great. We hope to have you on again. Chuck, any last words?
You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery with Mark Young, and we'll see you next time.